Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Religion in the public square, the topic of our hour today. Of course, with Mitt Romney and John Huntsman running for president, John Huntsman has now dropped out, but Mitt Romney seems to be the front runner for the Republican nomination. The Mormon moment has continued. Also discussion of would we vote for a Muslim candidate for president. Newt Gingrich spoke out about that just yesterday. Questions about whether evangelicals will vote for a Mormon candidate. Is it a good thing when faith and politics are closely aligned? We'll ask these questions and many others and hope to have your questions and comments as well. In the first segment, we'll talk about a new LDS caucus in the Utah Democratic Party. We'll talk with Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus and with LDS Dems Vice Chair Crystal Young Otterstrom. And we'll spend the majority of the program talking about the new Pew Center poll, Mormons and Evangelicals, the limits of Americans' religious tolerance and how that affects politics, with Notre Dame Associate Professor David Campbell, who is co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. And he's director of Notre Dame's Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy. We'll also have with us Philip Barlow, Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture and director of USU's Religious Studies Program. And we begin with the conversation I had yesterday with Democratic Party Chairman for Utah, Jim DeBacchus, who is in Logan today, but his schedule was so jam-packed, we talked yesterday. Here's that conversation. This part of the program, we're talking with Utah Democratic Party Chairman Jim DeBacchus, and we're going to be talking about Mormons and the Democratic Party. In fact, this entire hour is on religion and politics. And there's a poll out from Trinity College in Connecticut, which you could see as depressing to the Democrats in Utah, or you could see it as an opportunity. They say that, according to this poll, the margin by which Mormons favor Republicans has grown. Also that some 59% of Mormons see themselves as Republicans versus 14% Democrats. That's nationwide. The news is even worse for the Democrats in Utah. Among Mormons, range is two-thirds see themselves as Republicans, and just 7% identified themselves as Democrats. This comes on the heels of an announcement from the Democrats that they've formed a new Mormon caucus. Jim DeBacchus, welcome to the program, first of all.
Thank you so much. I love the station, and whenever, particularly when I'm traveling through southern Utah, there you are. You have saved my life many a time.
Well, wonderful. We're glad you're listening. So the Mormon caucus, 7% is at least according to this poll, is where you're at versus two-thirds of Mormons say they're Republicans. You obviously see some room for growth. What do you hope to accomplish with the Mormon caucus?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, the Republicans have been very, very good at messaging over the last generation, really, and creating this straw dog about what a Democrat is. And then Democrats have spent a lot of time pointing to the straw dog and saying that's not what we are. So I compliment the Republicans who have painted this false impression of what a Democrat is. And I hope that we're going to begin to chip away at that false image about what a Utah Democrat is. So that's an important part of where we need to go.
So you say this is a false straw dog, good marketing campaign by the Utah Republicans. The Republicans strike back. I've seen the quotes from Thomas Wright, the Republican chairman, saying that if you just take the two platforms, national platforms, and put them side by side, he thinks most Mormons would still side with the Republicans.
Well, the problem is that the national platforms really are not in play here in Utah. The Republican Party has had the control of the state, of the executive branch, and overwhelming majorities in the legislature for the last 27 years. And if you look at the fruit of that supposed leadership, you see so many gigantic flaws. And as over the last few years, as the Republicans have become increasingly cowing over to this fringe element within their own party, this Republican part of the party, it's even worse. So this moderate, reasonable, common sense, problem-solving Democrat compared to these real extremists that are in the Republican Party is a good balance that we need to begin to show the people of Utah that your Democrat neighbors really can solve the big problems, whereas the Republicans are so interested in the ideology that they're missing out. We are 51st, and we have been for the last 27 years in funding for education. We are 42nd when it comes to overall education, and Democrats say, you know what, that's not good enough. We really are the party of family values. The Republicans are blah, 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 but year after year, decade after decade, generation after generation, we have this legacy of accepting being 50th in education. Those aren't family values. Those are making our children not competitive for what's ahead. And it's a very, very serious issue. So education is one example, and there are many where the values and the ideas of the Democratic Party align much better than the extremists that have taken over the Republican Party.
There are some key issues, though, aren't there, that may be difficult to bridge a divide, such things as gay rights, abortion, some other things?
If you look at the Utah State Democratic platform, our abortion policy mirrors the LDS Church's policy. The Democratic Party of Utah has never called for gay marriage. It has said that all citizens, including gay and lesbian citizens, should not be discriminated against in housing and employment. And guess what? That exactly mirrors the LDS Church's position. So it is the Republicans that are out of step, again, with the extremist position that they are against abortion, even in the case of the life of the mother, that they are against protecting all Utah citizens against housing and employment discrimination. These are issues that, like so many Republican issues, where they want to do away with public education, where they want to have voucher system, where they want to do away with food inspections. I mean, this whole spectrum of extremism that you find Utah, look at Senator Hatch. He served the country. He served the state. He was always conservative. But this last little while, when he watched what happened to Senator Bennett, he's turned into a complete extremist. He's groveling before the extremists in the Republican Party. The same Senator Hatch that year after year sponsored the so-called DREAM Act, which says if you've come into this country as a 3 or a 4 or a 5-year-old and you've been educated in elementary schools and in high schools and you've in junior high, and you get a diploma from a Utah school, you can get college tuition, even though your parents may have been illegal. That kind of humanity that Senator Hatch found so strong that he co-sponsored it many years, suddenly, oh, the DREAM Act, it's terrible, it's wrong, it's this, it's that. It's just one example of where this extremism has chased Utah politicians, that the normal working, reasonable people of the state no longer have any connection to these Utah Republican politicians.
Just a couple of questions. Where does an effort like the Mormon Caucus fit in? Is this central to a plan to win more elections?
Yeah, you know, part of the other part of the overwhelming majority of LDS people being Republicans has frankly been a not very good job by Utah Democrats of having a tent that welcomed LDS people. Democrats pride themselves on being the party of inclusion and everybody's welcome. And somehow, strangely, we have too often accepted from that invitation and welcome LDS people. So our giant Democratic tent needs to work on, and we are working on, and the LDS caucus is a part of that work in welcoming LDS people and making sure that when LDS people come into our Democratic tent, they feel welcome. They feel like their views, their ideology, their views of life are not only tolerated but appreciated, welcomed, and inculcated into the thinking of the state. That's something that we Democrats have begun to do, and we think that LDS Dems will play a significant part in helping that process.
We're going to continue this conversation with Crystal Young Otterstrom, who's heading up the Democrats' Mormon caucus. One final question, Mr. Dubakis. It was rumored that you might be on a short list for a post back in Washington, D.C. I see reports lately you say you're going to stick around in Utah.
You know, the choice came to accept this. I was very flattered to be offered this position in Washington. It paid a great deal of money, but I love what I do. I've loved being the Democratic State Party chair. It's a wonderful job, and I get to spend a whole day in Logan from 7:30 in the morning until 9 at night. That wouldn't happen if I went to Washington, and I just love Cache County. I love this state. I'd rather work for a dollar a year here than big money in Washington.
Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing much more from you. Legislative session coming up and much more happening. Of course, elections later in the year. Jim Dubakis, chairman of the Utah Democratic Party. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. That's my recorded conversation from yesterday with Jim Dubakis. He is in Logan today, but his schedule was so packed that we recorded our conversation yesterday. You're welcome to join this conversation. We're talking for another few minutes about the new LDS Dems caucus. It's an official caucus in the Utah Democratic Party, catering to people of LDS faith. And we're talking about religion and politics in general for the entire hour. Later on, we're going to bring in Philip Barlow from USU and David Campbell from Notre Dame. David Campbell is author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Let's bring in Crystal Young Otterstrom now. As I understand it, you are vice chair of the LDS Dems caucus?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me on your program today.
We appreciate you, and I believe you were able to listen to my conversation with Jim Dubakis. I just wanted to continue that conversation. First, the caucus has been in existence since October, I believe, or thereabouts. What has the response been?
The response has been absolutely exciting. We've been hearing from far too many people who thought that they were the only Mormon Republic or the only Mormon Democrats, in the state, which of course isn't true. There's not only hundreds, but there's thousands. We've also been hearing from a number of former Republicans who have made the change to the Democratic Party in just the last year or two. People like our own Jimmy Rivera, who lives in Daybreak, and he works for Walmart. He's a former Republican. He was even involved in a great number of campaigns in Colorado, and he has a disabled daughter, and he just didn't appreciate how people in the Republican Party responded to his daughter and how politicians weren't making the decisions that would help his daughter succeed in life. And so he's become not only a Democrat, but a very active LDS Democrat.
Is it fair to say that the points you'll be emphasizing, this is just conventional wisdom, I'll see if you can confirm this, would seem to be social justice, care for the poor? That's where maybe you would try to align parts of the Democratic platform and mission with the beliefs of LDS.
Absolutely. You know, I meet people every day who say, how can you be an active Mormon and a Democrat? And honestly, it's harder for me to understand how people can be a Republican and an active Mormon. But I'm not saying you can't. I know many wonderful Republicans who are faithful members of the church, who live their lives in exactitude and have love and caring for those around them. But I, you know, with that statement you mentioned earlier with Thomas Wright, where he says, compare the platforms. Well, do compare the platforms. And I absolutely agree with my brethren's statement where they say there's elements of truth in each people's party. But when you look at the Republican Party, I mean, where in our doctrine does it say give tax breaks to billionaires, and yet we can't extend a simple payroll cut to small business owners like my own husband? You know, those are the kinds of values people need to look at. And definitely, you know, poverty and taking care of the poor and needy, which is the fourth pillar of our church, you know, our new fourth pillar. That's definitely a major focus of Democrats. In fact, I'd say it's our core value for many of us and is really what got us looking at the Democratic Party in the first place. I have Republican parents myself. I grew up Republican. And when I was a student at Brigham Young University, I'm an alumna, that's where I really started looking at things and saying, you know what, I don't see a lot of the scriptures I know and love in these Republican principles.
So would you say that, it's an interesting question, would you say that your religion drives your politics?
Absolutely. You know, so many Democrats, we do love to paraphrase the famous statement by Senator Reid, even though so many of my fellow Mormons don't have high approval ratings of him. But he says, you know, he's a Democrat because of his Mormonism and not in spite of it. And that's definitely a feeling that so many of us echo. You know, a lot of people say, well, don't you have to go through mental gymnastics to make these things in line with each other? And I say, absolutely not. You know, my good friend Jim DeBacchus talked earlier about abortion, and there are many Mormon Democrats who are pro-life, who are not in favor of gay marriage. I know Mormon Democrats who are pro-choice, but personally, they're against gay marriage, but as a policy, they think abortion should be legal. I do know gay Mormons, but I also know Mormon Democrats who are pro-gay marriage. So we are a big tent on those issues. You don't have to agree one way or the other. And, you know, really think about the church's positions on those issues. You know, the church has come out in favor of Salt Lake City's anti-discrimination ordinances. There's now ordinances, I think, in something like 12 or 18 cities in Utah now that protect people's rights to housing and employment. And wouldn't it be amazing if we could have something like that statewide in Utah, a state where religion is so important, where so many of us in this state strive to live Christ-like lives? I think that means extending that arm of protection to those who are different from us.
You just brought up a couple of points, and we talked about those with Mr. DeBacchus as well. Those are two I hear, you know, if you ever get around to talking in social circles about Mormons and Democrats. If you look at the national platforms regarding abortion and gay rights with the Democrats, don't you think that may be a sticking point for picking up new Mormon Democrats in Utah?
I think definitely it takes some education on our parts. You know, I personally am in the camp where I would never have an abortion in the case of extreme endangerment to my life. You know, I mean, that's honestly a question I can't really answer since I haven't been in that situation yet. And I know Mormon women who've made decisions both ways, where some of them did terminate the pregnancy and some of them opted to have the child and they still survived. So I couldn't answer that personally. But I personally do think, as a policy standpoint, though, that we shouldn't be legislating our vision of what is right and wrong based on our religious beliefs. I firmly believe in the separation of church and state. And as many Mormons realize, you know, our religion wouldn't exist without that separation of church and state. And so we need to really look carefully about when we choose to legislate, say, what is good governance versus what are our own religious principles? And are we making a decision because of our religious beliefs, or are we making a decision because it's good policy? And so it's important to think about that difference as we legislate and really make sure we're not taking away people's agency because we're trying to make the world match our moral vision. And so we really have to be careful to make that balance work. And that's something that Democrats really care about, is we love the Constitution. We love the freedoms provided in the Constitution. It's an amazing document. After thousands of years of history, we finally get to this point in history where people can be truly free. And we need to make sure we protect that with every tool we have in the closet. And we need to make sure we're not taking away people's freedoms just because we want them to live a better moral life.
We're talking on this part of the program with Crystal Young Otterstrom, who is vice chair of LDS Dems. That's a new official caucus within the Utah Democratic Party. We talked earlier with party chairman Jim DeBacchus. Democratic Party in Utah is trying to reach out to Mormons. And the figure right now in polls is 7% of LDS people identify as Mormons. Obviously, the Utah Democrats would like to increase that.
I thought it was 17%, but you could be right.
Okay, let's go to a caller. I think we'd like to talk with Ms. Young Otterstrom. Emily in Millville, did I get that right?
Yes.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
Well, I'm not a registered as a Democrat, but I feel like I align myself more liberally than most Mormons.
That's great.
But I've thought a lot about this abortion issue myself, and I feel like I'm personally pro-life, but I feel like a more liberal approach to it is to kind of focus on education for younger people so that we offer them options instead
Absolutely.
Of pushing abortion. You know, we can do sex education and... Anyway, that's my thought.
Emily, I wonder if I could ask you, you're obviously thinking along these lines. A lot of people probably see this in general, that abortion might be a sticking point. If you look at the national platform for the Democrats, definitely pro-choice. You consider yourself to be pro-life. Would that be a roadblock for you to registering as a Democrat?
Well, I have been registered as a Democrat in the past, but I switch when I want to, you know, participate in whatever primary. But no, I don't think it is. I think I can be pro-life and pro-choice. And I can be pro-choice and I choose life and allow other people to choose, but to choose beforehand by, you know, having that sex education available to them and to choose before they get pregnant, you know, to protect themselves from pregnancy instead of having to go through abortion. That's kind of how I get around that issue, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Emily, and I really like how you put that, how you're pro-choice and you choose life. I may use that if you don't mind. But I think that's definitely the solution, is education. We do need to not be afraid to talk about our children, about these issues, talk to them about safety, and talk to them about abstinence, and talk to them about all the ways that they can be safer in general about their lives. You know, I went to high school in Texas, and it was definitely the kids whose parents never educated them very much, and we have, you know, very limited sex education in Utah, in Texas and in Utah, but, you know, those were the kids who definitely were messing around a lot more than the ones whose parents educated them more. And my parents actually did educate us, and I'm glad that they did.
Thank
and
you.
I always was good in that area.
Well, appreciate the call, Emily.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Just the last question for Crystal Young Otterstrom. I believe there is contact information if people are interested in the new LDS Dems caucus. I believe there's a website.
Yeah, absolutely. Our website is ldsdems.org, ldsdems.org. You can also send us an email at hello@ldsdems.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Please join us.
Very good. Crystal Young Otterstrom, who is vice chair of the new LDS Dems caucus. Previously, we heard from the party chairman, Jim DeBacchus. There's a new LDS caucus within the Utah Democratic Party. Coming up, following a break, we're going to continue discussion of religion and politics. We'll talk about religious pluralism in America. Is it a good thing when faith and politics are closely aligned? What is some of the history of recent history of politics and religion? We'll talk with the co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, Notre Dame Assistant or Associate Professor David Campbell, and with Philip Barlow, who is the director of USU's Religious Studies Program. Talk about whether people vote for a Mormon for president. Would they vote for a Muslim for president? That came up recently with Newt Gingrich. Talk about those questions. Hopefully your questions and comments at 1-800-826-1495. Following the break.
Commentator Thad Boggs.
I come from a long line of fiercely independent game harvesters and bee tree hunters. Such people were different from those who plowed the land and grew beans for the table or cotton to sell, or those that almost eliminated deer and quail from overhunting. They hunted wild animals, but they were careful not to kill the producers in the population. Does and fawns were not killed, and grain was left in the field for the wild turkeys. Once a bee tree was found, honey was taken, bees put in a box, and moved to an area with abundant flowers and water. But now bees and wild pollinators are declining, both worldwide and right here in Cache Valley. If they become scarce, our food supply will decline, and the world as we know it will change. Bees are not dying because of overhunting. We humans have changed our community so wild things, large or small, suffer from our human quest for comfort. Grandpa considered his property was his to use any way he wanted, capturing wild bees and making them livestock, shooting chicken hawks or trapping varmints were rights derived from being the dominant force created by God. Stewardship was guided by biblical ideas where a man was given dominion over all things. As science developed, we began to understand that living systems depended more on cooperation than domination. In our zest to kill pests, we spray our wetlands to kill mosquitoes, use chemicals to kill weeds, and put systemic pesticides on our lawns and croplands. Those are actions of domination, not cooperation. We and the bees will suffer the consequences. This is Thad Boggs.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crump Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now with new hours, open Monday through Saturday 7 until 3 and Saturday 8 until 3, offering a changing menu of French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits and serving lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for staying with us through the break. We're continuing our discussion of religion and politics on Access Utah today. We talked about the new LDS caucus within the Utah Democratic Party, and that got us into some of the issues that I'd like to continue in this part of the program, specifically how much does a person's religion inform their political views, or vice versa? How is the state of American religious pluralism? Specifically, do people think they'll vote for a Mormon president or a Muslim president? That question came up with Newt Gingrich just yesterday. Heard that report on All Things Considered. We're going to be talking about this with David Campbell, who is associate professor at Notre Dame University and author, co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. He's also director of Notre Dame's Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy. And Professor Campbell, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. We have with us in studio Philip Barlow, Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture at USU and Director of USU's Religious Studies Program. Professor Barlow, welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
Let me start with you, Professor Campbell. your book. I think this may get us into this topic. Could you talk about the title, American Grace, and maybe how that states, I believe, in your view, an ideal state? And of course, the whole book treats, in part at least, how well we're approaching that or not approaching that.
Well, the book poses a question, or maybe we might think of it as a puzzle, and that is, how can America be at the same time a religiously devout country, and America actually is quite a religious country, while also being religiously diverse? We have a remarkably diverse array of religions across the United States, and yet also be a religiously tolerant country. We might think that religious devotion and religious diversity together would produce strife and conflict, whereas in the United States, we actually find that most people get along with people of another faith. Now, there are exceptions to that, and Mormons, to some extent, actually are an exception, an important one and an interesting one. But the overall story is what we describe as the grace of America, meaning that over the same period of time that Americans have polarized politically, and that has some religious overtones to it, our personal relationships have actually become much more religiously diverse. And so the thing that has kept that political polarization from ripping the nation apart along religious lines is the fact that on an individual and personal level, Americans are actually very comfortable with making friends of people with another faith, often having members of other religions within their families, and often even within their own homes with religious intermarriage, which is increasingly common.
You say that this is increasing, but a couple of exceptions, to some extent Mormons, and to a larger extent Muslims.
That's correct.
The polls have shown.
And what's interesting to note, though, is that while those two groups perhaps don't come as a surprise that they would not be viewed positively by the rest of America, there's actually another group that we tested. We're not claiming this is the only other one that is sort of falls outside that umbrella of fully acceptable religions, and that's Buddhism. And the reason that we decided to ask people about their reactions to Buddhism is we wanted to pick a religion that we thought was pretty innocuous and doesn't necessarily get good press or bad press, but is just sort of neutral. And we nonetheless find that Buddhists actually are rated by Americans, that is non-Buddhist Americans, comparable to Muslims and Mormons. You know, not exactly the same, but they're sort of in that same negative area. And that suggests that there's something going on here that isn't just bad press and isn't necessarily just theological differences that people might have with these faiths, but instead we argue that it actually has to do with just straight familiarity, that Americans are not comfortable with faiths with which they are unfamiliar, and Buddhism, Islam, and Mormonism, for most Americans, are unfamiliar.
We turn to Professor Barlow. Do you agree with that, especially as regards Mormonism, that as people generally come to know Mormons and then the Mormon faith better, that there will be more acceptance?
Yes, certainly. There's an important geographical component to that in the case of many religions, but particularly the LDS faith, with its strong concentration in the West as opposed to the eastern United States, and in the Intermountain West in particular, and in Utah in special particularity. Conversely, the Mormons have an issue themselves because of geography, and that is who they know, not just who they are known by. So the recent Pew survey on Latter-day Saint attitudes and perspectives on the world and how the world views them included a question about Mormons and friends. Are their very close friends Mormons or not Mormons? And the majority of Mormons, and especially here in Utah, have all or most of their friends are Mormons. And that's not, for the most part, that's not because they're condescending towards outsiders so much it is who they know. Mormons are kind of tribal and very busy in their church activities. Mm.
Professor Campbell, you had a question, a series of questions in your polling, didn't you, about who your friends are, and there are some differences depending on what religion your friends are and how religious your circle tends to be.
Yeah, and the results actually are fascinating because the general story is that most Americans have within their tight friendship networks, that is among their closest friends, or within their own family, people of other faiths. So almost all of us have an Aunt Susan who is of a different religion than we are, someone we know and love, but nonetheless worships in a different way. There are a few exceptions to that, though, or there are some groups that are less likely to, the word we use is bridge to other religions, and actually Mormons stand out as the one religious group in America that is actually the most tight-knit, so the group that is the least likely to make connections outside of their own faith, both among their friends and within their families, are Mormons. And the groups that are comparable to Mormons are quite interesting. They are Black Protestants and Latino Catholics. And I emphasize the Black and the Latino as I mention those groups because those are groups defined as much by ethnicity as they are by religion. Mormonism doesn't have an ethnic component per se, although you might think of Mormonism as itself being sort of a pseudo-ethnicity, and that seems to be what we're reflecting in the tight-knitted nature of Mormon social connections. And as Professor Barlow mentioned, this is not something that is only concentrated among Mormons in Utah. This is actually something we find all over the country, and it has to do with the fact that Mormons invest a lot of time and energy within the church, and so therefore they make friends within the church, and then obviously the church places an imperative upon marrying within the faith, much more so than other religions do, and that's going to keep families religiously homogeneous.
I'd like to talk about this divide and how it affects politics between evangelicals and Mormons. This is playing out right now. Maybe, maybe not. We'll find out with the primary election coming up on Saturday in South Carolina. A quarter, beyond evangelicals, one poll states that one quarter of Americans is uncomfortable with the thought of a Mormon president. And then you come specifically to evangelicals, many of whom have big problems with Mormon theology. And that does affect their political leanings in some respects. I wonder if you could address that, Professor Campbell.
Well, it's interesting that we've been polling, or we, not me personally, but, the people who do polls have been asking Americans whether they would be willing to vote for a Mormon for president since 1967. When George Romney, Mitt Romney's father, was first running for president, way back in a different era. And that number that you quoted of about 25% of the population openly saying that they were uncomfortable or even unwilling to vote for a Mormon presidential candidate, quite amazingly, has held steady since 1967. It held steady through the 1990s. It held steady when Mitt Romney first ran for the presidency in the last cycle there in 2008. And it's more or less held steady now. And you're right that opposition is largely concentrated among evangelicals, but not entirely. There's actually another segment of the population who are also uncomfortable with Mormons, and those are people who are highly secular, who are not necessarily objecting to any sort of specific theological claim that Mormons make the way evangelicals might, but are probably just averse to highly religious candidates of any type and might be particularly uncomfortable with the LDS Church, either because of their unfamiliarity with it or because of misconceptions they might have about it, or they just might not like the way it's organized or the particular teachings that it has. Now, the highly secular group, that's not going to cause a candidate like Mitt Romney much trouble because those folks are staunch Democrats and not likely to vote for any Republican, whether it be Mitt Romney or anyone else.
Professor Barlow, I'd like to get your reaction to this divide, which is, at least you talk to evangelicals, it's based on theology from their point of view, and therefore I don't know if that's bridgeable. Do you think that's that bridge is able to be narrowed?
The way you put it just just in your last phrase, I do agree with. I do think the bridge can be and is being narrowed. I'm involved in conversation with some evangelical leaders, and there are attempts at bridge making, but it's strong. I say amen to everything Professor Campbell just said. The secular or from the left reservations about Mormonism include not only what he said, but sometimes specific allegations. Can we trust a president who believes in angels and strange things to have his finger so close to the nuclear button, for instance? Those kinds of crazy sort of questions, maybe legitimate concerns, but not legitimate presumptions. And the evangelical concerns are theological, and some of them are the echoes of theological concerns. For instance, if we have a President Romney in the White House, will that legitimate Mormonism in the eyes of the culture or the world? And will that therefore do traditional Christianity some harm? And then one more point, kind of the other side of some coin or another, is that Mormons themselves were much more evenly divided as Democrats and Republicans up to the late 60s and early 70s. And what triggered that veer to the right was the Cultural Revolution, the Roe versus Wade decision, and the emerging drug culture, and the dissolution of traditional family connections and that sort of thing. And so the perception emerged in those decades. But as I was listening to your earlier segment this morning, it's not the case that in the first half of the 20th century, Mormons were as thoroughgoing Republicans as they are today.
Mm. If you just joined us, we're talking about religion and politics, specifically as regards the continuing Mormon moment. Mitt Romney, the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination. John Huntsman was in the race, dropped out. We're talking with Philip Barlow, who is in studio with us, who is director of USU's Religious Studies Program, and with Notre Dame Associate Professor David Campbell, co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. You're welcome to join this conversation if you'd like. We'd love to have your comment or question at 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495 is the number. 800-826-1495. I'd like to review some of that history Professor Campbell, Professor Barlow brought up. I think what you call it a major earthquake in terms of religion and politics. There have been a couple of aftershocks, as you call them, and where we are now, as I've read, is a sort of a backlash. And I think it's the third largest religious group now is the nuns, people who don't identify with any given religion. And I believe you say that those people are a bit suspicious of people who are so closely aligning their faith and their politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the more fascinating and frankly not well noted or much discussed phenomena in American society has been the rise of the group that you've just mentioned, the nuns, as we call them. Now, I'm at Notre Dame, so I need to be careful that people
That's
understand
right.
what I mean by that. It's not the N-U-N-S kind of nuns, but rather the N-O-N-E-S kind of nuns. That is, people who, when asked, what's your religion, reply, well, none, I don't have one. And we've seen a rapid acceleration in the percentage of the American population who say they have no religion over roughly the last 20 years or so. You know, for as long as we were collecting data, that was about 5 to 7% of the American population would say, I don't have a religion. And then late 1980s, early 1990s, right around that period, we saw this sharp spike upward of people who, when asked, what's your religion, would say, well, I don't really have one. And our explanation for that, and we're actually, my co-author Bob Putnam and I, we're not alone in making this argument. Our explanation for that is what is happening is an increasing proportion of the American population who are either political liberals or maybe even just political moderates, but certainly not political conservatives. They associate religion with right-wing politics. And because that's not their politics, they don't want the religious baggage that comes with it, and therefore they don't want to be thought of as religious because to them, religion equals a particular flavor of politics. And so what this all means is people's politics is actually driving their religion, or really their irreligion, or their move away from religion. And our data are pretty clear on this, that we've seen even just in the last 5 years an acceleration yet again of the percentage of young people especially who say they have no religion, and it's clearly a response to this intertwining of religion and right-wing politics in the country. You know, when the religious right was formed, it was all about bringing traditional values to the public square, but it's had this unintended consequence now of actually turning a lot of Americans off of religion altogether.
Professor Barlow, you had a comment on this.
Yes, I don't disagree with any of that, except I do think that there's a strong drive in that same direction that is irreducibly religious or irreducibly in the realm of religious conversation as opposed to politics. So I think there's numbers of components driving that, and one of it is religious. That's the wrong word because they eschew the concept, the word, the label religion, but I am spiritual, not religious, is sort of the mantra of this rising generation. But I think it's part of a piece of an erosion of respect for institutions generally, which has some advantages mm-hmm. for individual liberty, but has some serious disadvantages because groups can accomplish things that individuals can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, if I could just weigh in on that, there is no daylight here between Professor Barlow and I. The nuns, as we call them, in large part are the folks who, as has been noted, will describe themselves as being spiritual but not religious, or at least our data show that these are people who have not completely abandoned religious beliefs. They overwhelmingly believe in God, for example. They're just not comfortable with the label of an organized religion. And that's what actually makes them so interesting, because they're kind of an untapped market, actually, for religious entrepreneurs that suggests that maybe they could be brought back to religion because they haven't completely abandoned it in the first place.
And in addition, thank you, I agree with that. And in addition, some of them are coming back to religious organizations. They're just horrified to call any of them churches or religions. So we're not a church. We're a family worship center, or mm-hmm. the phenomenon yeah. of mega churches and their rise and evolution. And in addition, even though I think, David, even the majority of these nuns are not atheists or hostile to spirituality, but there are some among them. Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and their followers and colleagues are gaining traction in a way that was less the case 20 years ago and 30 years ago. So there's that minority, but real and powerful mm-hmm. commentary. And in the context of the technology eruption in the internet and the online world means that there's a critical mass in conversation with one another and having an influence. So we shouldn't forget that.
Right. The way I often put it is there may not be all that many atheists in America, but man, they buy a lot of books.
Yeah, it's true. You do. It's on the bestseller list usually. I want to talk a bit about Muslims. This is perhaps even a more severe test of American religious pluralism and tolerance. And it's just ripped from the headlines. Yesterday, I heard Newt Gingrich responding to a question, would he support a Muslim running for president? And he said, yes, he would, but that Muslim would have to renounce Sharia law. I wonder, just in general, your thought about where we are in our journey of religious pluralism with regard to Islam. Let's start with Professor Campbell.
Well, one thing that's important to note about Americans' perceptions of Muslims in general and therefore of Muslim politicians is it isn't as though everything was fine up until September 11th, and then after September 11th, that's when the rest of America became cold or negative toward Muslims. The sad fact is that Muslims were not viewed very well prior to 9/11. We know a lot more about Americans' attitudes toward Muslims post 9/11, but we know something about it beforehand, and this was not a group that was viewed positively before the terrorist attacks that sort of raised the specter of radical Islam all around the world. Which suggests that whatever is going to happen, if we do want to see Muslims more fully accepted in American society, it's probably going to be a similar process that we've seen with other religions, including Catholics. You know, we forget that it wasn't all that long ago that there was a very strong element of anti-Catholicism in America, and that has largely now become a thing of the past, not entirely, but largely, and that suggests that there is actually hope for groups like Muslims and other minority religions as well, that they too can find full acceptance in American society.
Professor Barlow.
And in the particular case of the Mormons, there's an interesting ambiguity to the situation. I think I don't think the Latter-day Saints show themselves dramatically different than the wider U.S. population in struggling erratically towards a wider tolerance, which is a bit ironic given their difficult past in relation to the wider culture. But on some fronts, the changes are dramatic, and Mormon scholars and some evangelical scholars have been involved in conversations trying to come to a deeper understanding and tolerance of one another while clarifying theological differences. That's been going on in various sectors, especially in Southern California, with Mormons and Muslims who have cooperated on a number of important ventures together, charitable acts together, exchanges of scholarly conversation and non-scholarly conversation. A number of Muslim leaders have come up to Salt Lake City and visited with authorities here. So there's some very encouraging progress, especially run by a couple named Stephen and Judy Gilliland in the Southern California region.
If you just joined us, we're talking about religion and politics, focusing on Mitt Romney's run for president. Looks at this point like he'll be the Republican nominee, and so these questions of religion and politics likely will continue for the better part of this year. And if he gets elected president, then beyond that, very likely. If you'd like to join this conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495, the number, 1-800-826-1495. Professor Campbell, I'd like to throw out one of the questions on the reading guide for American Grace. Many of these questions are very good. These are designed for reading groups, of course, but this one strikes me particularly. Do you think it's good for the country when faith and partisan politics are closely aligned?
Well, I'll give you my answer to that. Reading groups that encounter the book may have come to a different conclusion, but my take on this is that it is actually a very toxic combination to see religion and I want to be clear here, partisan politics to be too closely intertwined. And I'll explain in a moment why I emphasize partisan. But just briefly, the reason why it's such a toxic combination is what I was referring to earlier, that we've seen what happens when religion becomes associated with one side of the political spectrum. It taints both religion and, frankly, the politics. You know, it wasn't all that long ago in American history that highly religious people were found in both parties in equal numbers. You know, when Dwight Eisenhower won his big landslide in 1956, America was this highly religious country, and he was winning votes from highly religious folks and highly secular folks. And, you know, all the way up through the 1970s, we did not see a sharp divide between the way more religious and less religious Americans voted. So this is all a relatively recent development. But decrying the mixture of religion and partisan politics is actually different than whether or not religion should speak out on political issues or policy issues. And I think there is a role for religion to do so. In fact, American history is replete with noble examples of religious leaders speaking out on the great moral issues of our day, whether it was slavery in the 19th century or other issues that we would find in the 20th or 21st century. the risk of religion being entangled with partisan politics is that it loses its ability to be a prophetic voice that transcends partisanship. You know, we just passed through Martin Luther King Day, and where did Martin Luther King find the power in his words? Well, they came largely from the Bible and religious imagery, but his message transcended a party. You know, he wasn't a political leader in the sense that he was running for office. He was speaking to a much wider audience and not bound by the baseness of a partisan appeal.
I'll ask Professor Barlow to defer his comments. I'm sure you do have comments on the question. We have a caller. I want to fit this in. Nadine in St. George. Nadine, I think you had a question or two.
Yes. Good morning. My concern is not so much, well, I believe firmly in the separation of church and state. I really, really do. That's pretty much what our Constitution tells us is the best formula for civil rights, freedom, and what have you. But when I was doing a PhD, I had to take a course in comparative religion, and part of that was doing a research paper in those days on Islam. And so I read a lot of the Quran, which terrified me. And the radical Islamists believe that, you know, absolutely. And if you are not them, they are entitled, according to the Quran, to do whatever they care to, which is cutting off your head, enslaving you, taxing you, whatever. And that is on the rise. And the problem with that is the moderate Muslims that want to just be in this country or wherever they are, make a living, raise their families, they generally don't assimilate particularly well, are intimidated, because I know personally some people who were approached by some of the radicals, and they say, you will do this with us, you will build a bomb, or you will do a shooting, etc., or we will rape your wife and your daughters in front of you. What, let you watch that, and then we will brutally kill you.
Nadine, well, let's get a response. We're just about out of time, so I appreciate that, and we'll try to cover this. I don't know which of my guests wants to tackle that in about a minute.
Well, why don't I just say this? There are often a lot of misunderstandings about religious groups we're not familiar with. You know, somebody who had never encountered Christianity could pick up the Old Testament and say, wow, this book says that we should stone adulterers. Or you could pick up the Book of Mormon and also draw what might be equally inflammatory passages out of that text. I think the more important thing is how American Muslims actually live out their religion, which would be true not just of Muslims, but it would be true of Christians and of Jews and of any other group we might think of. And the more that those personal connections are made, I think the more the non-Muslim America will recognize that actually they have a lot more in common with Muslims than they do not.
Professor Barlow, just 30 seconds.
I couldn't state that any better. My response would be the same. We shouldn't be naive. There are such things as fanatics and coercive fanatics, the definition of which for me is people who double their speed when they've lost their way. And adding coercion to that is not a pretty picture, but one can find it in Judeo-Christian scripture.
So I wish we had more time to cover Nadine's point. Nadine, if you'd like to treat that further, shoot me an email, tom.williams@usu.edu, tom.williams@usu.edu, and we'll try to cover that in greater detail on a later program. Thanks for listening. We've been talking about religion and politics with Professor David Campbell, co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. He's at Notre Dame. Professor Campbell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And in studio with us, Philip Barlow, Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture and Director of USU's Religious Studies Program. Thanks for coming in again.
Good to be with both of you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.